This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Dr. Marta Vicente, professor of history at the University of Kansas, to talk about her 2017 Cambridge University Press release, Debating Sex and Gender in 18th Century Spain. Hi, Marta. How are you today?
Hello, I'm fine. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, thank you for agreeing to join me. I'm so excited to talk to you. So how's Lawrence, Kansas today?
It's very cold. It's like it's like 14 degrees Fahrenheit, which I no longer translate. You know, I used to think in Celsius, but I don't know. It's very cold for like anyone who is like, what is like minus something Celsius anyway. So, and
yeah,
that's
really cold.
I'm still not used to this, but it's cold. It's cold, you know, hospitals are like filled with people with COVID, and it's just business as usual for a while, you know. Oh my God.
Yeah, it's the 2020 reality.
Yeah.
We are cozy inside, and we're talking about something really interesting today. So let's, not only can you and I have a little ray of sunshine, we shall give some sunshine to our listeners as well, hopefully. So my first task is to try to place this work in your academic narrative. So I'm looking at your earliest work on the late 18th century family businesses, and it's not a gender history per se, but it certainly elucidates the important role of women in family businesses. Women are an integral part of this story, and that in itself is worth noting, right? And then we see in the early aughts some your scholarship on women that was completely kind of au courant, right? Redefining what we understood to be conceptions of gender in early modern Spain, particularly Barcelona. And then the book we're talking about today seems to represent a much more modern exploration of the construction of sex, like in early modern Spain. So my question has two parts. Is this a fair characterization of your career? And secondly, how did you decide to write this book?
Yeah, it's totally fair. And I will put you even back in time with my senior thesis, I did it in Barcelona. So it's called licenciatura, which is the equivalent of a senior thesis, where I wrote about women in early modern guilds in Barcelona. So the guilds, which were the sort of like early modern version of the trade unions, let's say, there I began to explore the role or the place of women in the labor market in the 1600s and 1700s, and something that was very surprising to me to find out is that I could see like women were everywhere, and yet like my advisor at the time told me that no, that was not possible, that women were not guild members, and that it was just space for men. And so this the lack of representation of this aspect of women's history in the historiography sort of got me like asking for more, and from the guilds, and I moved to the factories for my dissertation that became the book, and so then at the root of all this interest in gender was also sexuality, and sort of trying to figure out why the absences of women in the historiography were also trying also translated into trying to understand the construction of sex and gender in the period. And that's what took me to this debating sex and gender in 18th century Spain. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, that's a wonderful answer. So I'm guessing that this move into kind of, I mean, it clearly just traces kind of a developing, growing interest. But I'm guessing there's also a source-based component to your decision to move into this work. And you note in your preface that you stumbled across a criminal case, and you know this book happened. So I want to hear broadly about what you're using in the book. And specifically, I want to know how a criminal case can lead to an exploration of the development of our understanding of how sex and sexed bodies are understood.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because sometimes, many times, the best sources are the ones that fall outside the logical place where one would go to search for, like, anything that has to do about sex. So, like, you know, one would, like, go to medicine records or like treaties and the fact was that as I think I said in the preface that it was not expected to find this manuscript. It's a very long file in the criminal archive. It's Archivo Histórico Nacional, so it's the main historical archive in Madrid. And so they had the criminal sort of, not archive, but the, what it's called? Well, the criminal files. And they, I was trying to put together a book on like theories on gender in 18th century Spain. And that was going nowhere, you know. It wasn't. I remember it was my birthday, and it was in Madrid in June. So I was in Madrid, and it was what I was reading was so boring. And I said, like, you know, I really enjoy Agatha Christie, and she has been an inspiration for my writing. So if anyone writes my book and sees anything in her, it's been a victory, a success. So I thought, like, well, let's have some fun and say. So I just look at some criminal files, and then I saw this one that was I forget the number of folios, but it was just very long. And then I began to read, and I realized that this particular document was about someone we now may identify as a transgender individual, a trans woman, because she wanted to be an actress, but was also a tavern keeper. And anyway, I thought it was so fascinating. And so changed focus and started writing the book. And actually, this book came out, I wrote a manuscript just having this main character as the protagonist, and the whole book was about Leirado. And then my husband said, like, this is not going to sell. And I look at it and say, well, this will sell in Spain and in Spanish, but clearly not for a Anglo-Saxon American audience. So I changed it, and then went back to the archives and looked for more documents that could provide like a solid context. And I think it's a better book. So my husband was right.
Okay. There's a lot of this character in your book, and I'm referring to him as a character. So we'll talk some more about that in a minute. One of the things that I find I like about this is you have this very clear story you're telling, but it intersects with so many issues, right? So this is, first of all, an attempt to kind of right the wrongs that have been done to Spanish history, right? Bring to the forefront the importance of the Spanish Enlightenment. This is the development of anatomy as a science, this newfound obsession with the body and its place in the natural / scientific world. New developments in the history of medicine, the ongoing negotiation between like science and religion, and I'm making air quotes around science and religion, which you can't see, but they're there. I'm curious, what do you consider to be your most important historiographic developments here? Like, what do you contribute?
Well, you know, it's interesting you are asking me that because, like, one inspiration for me was and is and was for this historian, Lacour, I hope I pronounced it right, Thomas Lacour, who wrote the book, I think it's called Making Sex, right? Yeah, or Sin, yeah? Is that right?
Yeah, Making Sex. Yeah. It's somewhere in my office, so I can't
it's
really
my,
see it, but
it's
yes.
It's in maybe my
Thomas
bibliography.
Lacour. Mm.
And so his basic main thesis is that the 18th century sort of like created this view of the sexes as two sexes model versus before with a more sort of like an understanding or like, well, he called it like one sex model. So the understanding that men and women were different, but basically they share the same sort of like common formation of like sexual organs, only that women had the organs inside and men outside. But yeah, the 18th century anatomists are like sort of creating this separation that no, that the genitals and the reproductive organs of men and women are totally different and separate. And in this new view of our modern understanding of sex and gender. So Lacour, as much as he's been so criticized, and there are a lot of scholars who believe that such a sort of like black and white picture is not correct, that before the 18th century there were sort of a lot of physicians that were sort of proposing this two-sex model. But I think that in essence his idea is correct. And I think that my contribution was to show that how this is happening in detail in one country and the impact that it had in terms of like the European knowledge of like sex and sexuality. So I think my contribution is showing how this actually happened. Because like Lacour provides a wide and broad analysis of how, you know, from the Greeks to Freud, and I didn't see anyone else doing this analysis in detail. So, is that answering?
Would you like to point out, can you explain to me why it is the case? Why debates about the sexed bodies are central to the understanding of this era? How is this a central issue to understanding the Enlightenment?
Yeah, that's a fundamental question I think that the book addresses, because I think it is in the 18th century that what in 20th and 21st century sort of like feminist thought it's been called is like the heteronormative project, which I wouldn't want to put that exactly in those words for 18th century because it's totally anachronistic, but I think it's the idea, behind is correct, that somehow linked to new ideas and developing ideas on the wealth of the nations are by, you know, Adam Smith, and that a lot of the men and few women of the Enlightenment sort of follow the ilustrados in Spain, that like the growth and the wealth of a nation was based on the number of sort of inhabitants, productive citizens of a country, then that translated like into the assuring the growth of the population. And that had to mean that controlling the reproduction and making sure that men and women sort of like procreate. And so, and in a way, people who were had gender and ambiguity, sexual ambiguity, were jeopardizing this project because they were not, hermaphrodites, as intersex people were called. I mean, hermaphrodites were jeopardizing, for instance, this project because they were not, they could not reproduce if they didn't have like complete sort of reproductive organs. And people who engage in sodomy, and they were not only sort of like morally to blame, but they were also not fulfilling a social function, and therefore were like also social, if you want, criminals. So all these outcasts, people who were outside these margins, were like sort of like control or try to bring into this idea of two bodies performing their assigned function in the reproductive process. And this also links to Foucault and his whole notion of biopolitics. And so how like bodies are like controlled for like a political purpose. So all this like mess of ideas are actually coming together in the 18th century. That's why I find the 18th century one of the most fascinating centuries ever. And I don't think it has been given enough credit. Because there are not as many people working on the 18th century as other centuries. But I find that it is right then when everything clicks. And we are still the children of the Enlightenment, whether we like it or not. So.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, no matter how hard we fight it, in some cases, absolutely, yeah. And the idea that there's something natural about the body, and the government should follow nature. I mean, there's a lot of nature wrapped into our understanding in the Enlightenment, and the sex body sits in there so nicely. So I want to read a passage before we start in to talk about kind of the body of your book. I just think it's beautiful. So you write, the chiaroscuro, an important concept in European art during the Renaissance and the Baroque, created an illusion of depth on a two-dimensional surface. The overarching light that the new anatomical findings were meant to create fell unevenly upon the reality of the lives of people in 18th century Europe. No matter how bright the light of order was, inevitably, it would create this combination of lights and shadows, adding depth and complexity to the Enlightenment project. The stories I'm going to tell construct a narrative that allows for shadows as well as lights, for recognition of the need for order, while also an acceptance of those who made such order, at the very least, problematic. And I think that's a really nice way to launch into the first chapter of the body of this book, The Anatomy of Sex, which looks at how anatomists and doctors of the era developed the idea that gender roles were linked to the traits of the sexed body. And now the central The central figure here is Martin Martinez. Can you tell our listeners about Martin and his story and what his story tells us?
Oh, I like it how you said Martin. Yeah. Well, he is, he was, and that's, he's one of the characters, one of the physicians that like, helped me to, sort of solidify this argument that I have that the Spanish Enlightenment not only existed, but it was it had a European component, because this although it's an early Enlightenment because it's the first half of the 18th century, but his ideas are not so much not only attuned to the what's going on in the European sort of anatomical theaters and works of other European physicians and anatomists, but also he engaged in with other physicians, exchange ideas. He was part of this like network of scholars interested in medicine, and so. He was a central in the distribution of, if you want, of like medical knowledge in Spain, but also outside Spain. So I was fascinated by this. By this character. It was very coincidental that at the time when I was working on this, like there was a graduate student here at the University of Kansas who was also doing his dissertation and interested in Martinez, and so we began to exchange ideas, and then I got even a more sort of like complex view of who this man was and how much his ideas were influential in the development of the this two sexes theory in Spain. I don't know what.
Yeah. Yeah, great. So the two-sex model, the two-sex model then has this idea that there are, you know, as you said, there are two distinct sexes. It's not just that, like, there's the same basic sex and things either go well or not. And, you know, like, there are two distinct sexed bodies with two sets of genitalia. But then there's this idea that the way people are meant to behave in society matches their genitalia. That like that is mm-hmm. definitive, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, it's important to remember, and that's something that I emphasize in the book, is that it's important to remember that that they are like back and forth. So it's like they are trying to establish this new way of thinking and this new way of seeing the body, and there is this like. There is this sense that they are into something new. So there is this self-awareness of novelty, which is I find very interesting and cute, because they constantly say like, well, we are in front of a new era. We are like the innovators, the novatores, they will, and they push the argument and they try to make it fit no matter what, but then suddenly like things go out of, you know, it's like, I don't know if you ever had this feeling of like getting into a store that has one size fit all dresses. Like there were those stores. Actually, I went to one of those in Amsterdam when I was in Amsterdam. It was a fantastic place. I mean, it was like everything was black and white. All the dresses, I mean, I love that city. At least when I went, I mean, it was just, oh my God. No matter, it rains, always rains. But and then it was like black and white and one size fits all. And then You put on the dress and it doesn't fit.
I mean, all 7 feet tall, you know, like women that size. Yeah.
And I'm like, how is that? It's one size fits all. It's supposed to fit. It doesn't fit. So that's what happened to all these like anatomies. They created this perfect model, this one size fits all, and they were convinced that it would like fit everything. I mean, like, which, and then they have the case studies. They have the all these like people who are just not fitting the model, and then they get mad because like it's not. And so there is all this like crazy thing going on. And now I forgot your question. What was your question?
You know, like actually, we're good now. We got through that. So actually, but what it would be perfect now is like let's talk about an example of how the dress doesn't fit.
Yeah.
let's talk about Sebastian. You can see now my Spanish accent is obviously horrible, and now I'm nervous. But no, Sebastian,
you use your Italian. You're just Italian. It's just more or less the same.
Yeah, Sebastian Nerado Lopez.
Good.
Okay. Yeah. So he's a 24-year-old innkeeper. Part-time actress from Madrid, whose gender and sex was ambiguous. So tell me about this person.
Well, I totally fell in love with this character because like first because the story represents so much many other stories that I read for the 18th century that were not as much fleshed out. So that I just got like maybe two pages on a case or like summary by some criminal case or like or inquisition, and I couldn't like, so this one sort of like it's sort of fleshed out, and you can see from the beginning of the end the story, and it's on one hand the complexity of human nature and sex and gender and sexuality and how people were sort of like trying to find their place in society when they were not fitting the categories that were imposed to them. And so the story of, and I call Leirado, Sebastian Maria, I struggle trying to figure out what pronouns to use and how to treat Leirado. Because I was still in my journey trying to be a queer historian or a queer scholar. I didn't know. Now I'm, the book that I'm writing, I think that I got a hang on it, and I'm more skillful using they all the time. But here I didn't know, and so Leirado has this conflict and just making a like very very a summary of Leirado's life. Leirado comes from a family of artisans and tavern keepers, artisans, and then ends up inheriting the family sort of business or like as a tavern keeper, but as a child or as a young boy was sent to become the apprentice of different masters, and one of the masters that two of the masters that he had, the Leirado had, was actresses. And actually they were famous and well-known actresses in Madrid. And then this character Leirado sort of becomes fascinated with the actresses and then starts a journey on like impersonating one of the actresses that worked for Maria Teresa Garrido, and actually sort of like spreads the rumor that first that the actress was had been expelled from the city of Madrid, And then Leirado, she comes back as Maria, and then all her lovers are supposed to call her Maria. And so reinvents herself as an actress and a singer. But of course, this is all underground, because, like, you know, her day job is a tavern keeper. So it's an actress and tavern keeper, and but the amount of the network that this person has all over Madrid in terms of, like, lovers, and so it's a fascinating story of how the underground, if you want, queer world of Madrid work. So because it was all lovers, the same-sex lovers and trans people and all this, how this is, at the end of the 18th century, is sort of like defying, going against any sense of a normativity that wants, like, female and male bodies acting in a heterosexual way. And that's what I thought it was so interesting about Leirado.
So he's sexed male at birth, right? And then and becomes a female impersonator. But then in chapter 4, we come back to Leirado as in this case. So tell me, what does he, how do you learn about him? Like, what, how does he enter the criminal record? Like, what happened? What is he brought up for?
Yeah. Well, the story is that one of Leirado's lovers, contracts, syphilis or I don't know. I think it's syphilis or some venereal illness. Yeah, and so the mother of this young man goes to the alcalde, goes to the sort of the judge or the criminal official in Madrid, and denounces Leirado because the mother says she is a woman who dresses as a man and has had, you know, has made my son sick. So actually, they go first and arrest Leirado for thinking it was a cross-dress woman. So it was a woman dressed as a tavern keeper, as a man. And so, which is very interesting, because when they go to arrest Leirado, the officials, the police ask him, are you a man or a woman? And then Leirado answers, you see me dressed as a man, then I may be a man. And so which is a very cryptic way of answering that idea. And then, you know, the police says, oh, whatever, you know, we'll take you.
Start this out later.
Yeah, exactly. We'll take you to the prison or to the alcalde. And then after they bring all these, like, testimonies and all this evidence, and at some point during the process, then it's officially a case of sodomy. So he's accused of sodomy and other misdemeanors, which means, like, cross-dressing. I mean, cross-dressing was not a criminal offense. It was a criminal, but it was a misdemeanor, so you could not be in jail for cross-dressing, but you could be sort of, like, asked not to cross-dress. But the sodomy was a major offense, and so that's how he ended up in this process, in this trial, and was you know, I don't know, should I reveal the ending? No one is going to read it. Should I tell you?
I don't know. Okay, spoiler alert. We're going to, if you're going to read and you don't want to know what's happening, stop listening now.
Okay, good. I can go ahead. So yeah. There is no death sentence. Killed for this. He's found guilty, but it's sent to a remote a remote prison in Navarra, which is north of Spain, very far from Madrid, where his family lives. And then there, surprisingly, a few years later, it's called indult. So the governor of Navarra, for some reason, decides to pardon the prisoners, mainly because there was some outbreak of an illness of some, and then like half of the inmates died, and so he ended up. Anyway, so we don't know what happened to him. We don't know if he survived and was able to go back to Madrid, or he actually died, which is most likely because he had probably an advanced case of syphilis. Yeah, an anecdote. I don't know if it's an anecdote, but I mean something that I thought it was like, I don't know, kind of sad or I don't know, is that. One of his, Leirado's claims to womanhood was that she menstruated, and then you know the doctors claim otherwise that it was not menstruation but something else, you know. So I don't know.
So interesting, this like their inability to handle. We don't, hermaphrodites don't exist. This isn't real anymore. So when faced with evidence to the contrary, there's just no way to make sense of that, right? So you have to deny this. I find it very interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think, and maybe that's what, like going back to the book, maybe I think that should have clarified this a little bit more. I don't think they say hermaphrodites are non-existent, period. But they say it's just very rare. It's very unlikely. It's just possibly not. So they make it very hard. And so they because again in this project they're making bodies fit into those two categories. It just doesn't fit that dress that I was talking about. Like, no. So they go well, and they come up with this idea that will become quite. You know, part of the medical sort of reasoning in the 19th century that they have underdeveloped genitalia or overdeveloped. So there's this idea of defective genitals rather than hermaphrodites, which for those of you who've known about or study about hermaphrodites before the 18th century, there was this fantastic component of hermaphrodite, this monstrous, but also this, they were called the wonders of nature. So is this like, kind of like mythical past of the hermaphrodite from the Greek sort of tradition. And it's like, so they want to get rid of all this like fantasy world. It's everything needs to be tangible and real and something you can touch. Leirado claims that he may be a hermaphrodite, and that's why his hemorrhoids are in fact to him like sign of like menstruation. But he's he or she, I keep saying he, but she, Leirado is a very clever character, because the way Leirado constructs the whole argument of the being a hermaphrodite is that others are claiming that that Leirado is a hermaphrodite, not themselves, you know. So that's what I think, that like the judges have a hard time trying to figure this whole matter out, and even the physicians who observe and try to sort of decide whether Leirado was a man or a woman. Also, they also had a hard time. And in the curriculum of this character, we find about 5 or 6 or 7, I forget, many sort of, I don't know how to call it, many physical tests to find out the sex, because it's not clear.
It's a point we won't get into, but I just want to note that I am continually impressed with how well early modern people who find themselves on the wrong end of the early modern justice system, how well they're able to negotiate mm-hmm. that path, right? Mm-hmm. Perhaps I'm a hermaphrodite, but someone else is saying that, not me. You know, it's very impressive.
I think it's like the looking at how Leirado sort of tries to navigate the judicial system. It's fantastic, because one of the things that I realized was that the fact that Leirado is lying about their age, so and claiming to be much younger than Leirado was probably, or well, what she certainly was, because I found the record of his the baptism. So and that is because I think that they knew about the younger people, 21 or younger, got sometimes a more sort of a less harsh punishment. And that also adds to the fact that Leirado had a very good network of contacts and friends in Madrid's prisons and jails. So they knew very well what was going on. So I'm sorry, you were going to ask me more and I stopped you.
That's great. Well, and you've already told me you fell in love with this character. You fell in love with this person and wanted to write the book solely about that. So I cannot be surprised that this is, you want to keep talking about it. So let's, in the interest of time, let's wrap up. So finally, you bring us to the present with a discussion of how the 18th century debates inform 20th and 21st century debates. How does that work? For what can we moderns thank our 18th century forebearers?
Yeah, that was deep inside the whole purpose of this book, which is like connect the 18th century with present ideas of sex and gender. And the last chapter of my book was difficult, not so much to write, but it felt very organic. But at the same time, I thought, well, you know, Cambridge, you know, it's not gonna want me to change this chapter because it's a little bit funky. Because I tried to make the case of saying how much of the 18th century views of sex and gender are here with us, and they permit and they inform and they shape the way we construct, we as Western society, or we construct sex, and how much and how difficult it is to get rid of this sort of binary construction of sex and gender. And I claim, I blame the 18th century people for that. Although at some point, I think in the introduction, I was really in the introduction, it said like, I say that everyone is entitled to, like, you know, failure or whatever. So the 18th century thinkers were not perfect. So they were trying to construct this, what I call this brave new world, and like this vision of like future and happiness that they had, and they didn't really get it right, but they tried, you know. So that's, and, yeah. So
what do you do?
Yeah, yeah.
We probably don't. 200 years from now, assuming we're even still around, they'll look back at us and wonder what we've done.
Uh-huh.
I am hoping.
Oh, Yana, I lost you.
Yeah, I lost you as well. All right. So let's pick up from here. Okay. So thank you so much for giving me so much of your time. But before we go, I have one last question.
Yeah.
So you're almost done with a new book, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm very excited.
I am very excited. Tell us about it.
Well, and it goes well when I just finished saying about the how the 18th century shapes the modern notions of sex and gender, because that is at the core of my next book, which has a title of Trans Confessions from the Inquisition to the Internet. So I'm looking over a long period of time from the 1500s to the present, transgender narratives that are expressed in form of confession. So declaring the truth of oneself and sort of revealing this the authentic self through this confessional genre. And in this, I want to explore how transgender narratives and literature that have been so much of great interest of people in the past 20 years, it's something that it's not new, and it's not even recent history. It's not like 19th or 20th century, but it's something that one can find it's shaping sort of notions of gender and sort of queerness, you know, as early as one can trace. But I start in the 1500s, and it covers several countries, so like the Spanish and Iberian world, of course, but also France and England, Germany, the United States and Canada. So it's the Western sort of societies.
Yeah. European diaspora.
Yeah.
oh, wow. That is, I'm so excited about that. I can't wait to, cannot wait to read it. I want you, if you need any eyes on it before, because I am that eager. It's fascinating. There's so many questions there. I think this really, it's incredibly ambitious, but I think it really has some great potential to help us rethink and reframe these debates.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, yeah, I should be done sometime soon.
And, you know, the hidden benefit of COVID, some of us are getting work done. Some of us, myself, not so much, but all right. So thank you so much. And I will be in touch about doing another one of these for the new book as well.
Thank you. Well, good luck with everything. Your program is fantastic. I'm going to subscribe to all these apps and get into the new world of podcasts. Well, it's not so new, but you know.
News relative. Brave new world indeed.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Ciao.